This is Fresh Air. We're living in the middle of the AIDS epidemic while witnessing a return of the tuberculosis epidemic. My guest, Sheila Rothman, has been studying the tuberculosis epidemic of the 19th and early 20th centuries. She says that epidemic set the pattern for both personal habits and public policy and influenced American attitudes toward illness and death. Rothman is the author of the new book, Living in the Shadow of Death, Tuberculosis and the Social Experience of Illness in America. The period she writes about ends in the 1940s with the discovery of the antibiotic streptomycin. She told me why she wrote A Social History of Tuberculosis.
TB is probably the disease that's more intertwined with American history than any other disease. It really appears right around the time of the Revolution. It may have been there in the colonial period, but when you first really start to read about it, it's kind of right after the Revolution. And beginning in about 1800 and continuing into the 1920s, it was the leading cause of death. In the early period, from 1800 till about 1870, it was responsible for one out of every four deaths, which is rather incredible when you think about it. And it ran across class lines, across religion, young even more than old, women even more than men, rural as well as urban. So there was no one who was untouched by it. At one point, when I was looking at materials, I found that in 1852, when Franklin Pierce is elected president, his wife Jane, who came from a family where there was lots and lots of tuberculosis, was thought to have it. And no one's really clear whether she did die from it or not. The vice president couldn't be inaugurated because he was in Cuba trying to cure his TB. And the Secretary of State had just lost one of his sons, and his wife had died earlier from the disease. So you can see that it was really the disease of the country, the disease people feared most. It was called the Great Destroyer.
Until the bacteria that caused tuberculosis was discovered in 1882, nobody realized that it was contagious. How did people think it was spread?
They had a tradition of medicine that was really based from the time of the Greeks on a notion of the balances of the body. And they saw tuberculosis as arising from irritations, either in the environment or in the lifestyle of the person. And their idea was, how did you cure the disease? By rebalancing the body, which meant that a person had to change their lifestyle and their environment. And particularly for people who were in very irritating climates, which were considered for tuberculosis, wet, damp, cold, like New England, and very irritating lifestyles, which meant indoor activity, sitting at a desk, not exercising your body, not getting out, not giving your body a chance to grow strong. Those were considered the problems. And so the cure became to try to change environment and change lifestyle. Go to a mild climate, go to a soothing climate, begin to take up outdoor exercise, or begin to involve in an activity such as farming, botany, surveying for men, which would keep them out of doors.
The American West was thought to have restorative powers for people who had tuberculosis. Were a lot of people told to go west?
That is one of the most fascinating and probably untold stories of American history. We first begin to understand this, and it kind of trickles back to the West with the first explorers who go out there. And they come back, and they're telling stories of how when they get over the Rockies or they get onto the Southwestern Plateau, everybody's coughs dries up, and they begin to spread the word that this is the best place to cure one's consumption. And so people began to really start to go West. And it was thought that by even taking this overland voyage, going by wagon or going by horseback, you would strengthen your body so in the outdoors that by the time you got to California, you would be cured. And at least a third of the settlers of Colorado and a quarter of the settlers of California were people who came there for it to cure their consumption.
You write that in the days before doctors knew that tuberculosis was caused by bacteria, there were different treatments prescribed for men than for women.
That was one of the most fascinating parts of the book for me when I discovered that. It took me a while to really understand, until I had really read enough manuscript papers, what was going on. The optimal cure, as physicians saw it, was, as I said, to change environment, to change occupation, to, quote, travel for health. And that was one of the important markers. And I began to realize, as I read the papers, that physicians would often tell men to travel for health, but women weren't really told that. This may be one more example of so many that we've had. But as I got deeper and deeper into the papers, what I discovered was that the women and their physicians had kind of negotiated an agreement The women's gender obligations were so strong, they were so determined to stay at home and to make sure that their children were raised properly, and as one of them would say, to train their children to be orphans, to make it possible for them to have the kind of training that would enable them to live in other people's homes, that they kind of worked out an arrangement with their doctors that they would cure, that they would do outdoor exercise and so on, as they were doing their domestic responsibilities. And so the physicians who shared their social values went along with this arrangement. So it's not a question of physicians not offering this, but physicians understanding the importance of one's social values and the importance of gender obligations and giving the women an opportunity to fulfill this.
My guest is Sheila Rothman, author of the new book Living in the Shadow of Death, Tuberculosis and the Social Experience of Illness in American History. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Sheila Rothman. After the bacteria that causes tuberculosis was discovered in 1882, doctors realized tuberculosis was contagious, and apparently that changed everything. It changed how society saw the sick. It changed the relations between the sick and their doctors and the sick and their community. What were some of the results of the fear of contagion once people realized that this disease was contagious?
Well, the changes were incredibly dramatic, and many people begin to think of the history of tuberculosis at the moment when Koch made the discovery. And many books which talk about this start in 1882 as if that's the point. And so when you look that way, the changes don't seem momentous because it seems as if the building of sanatoriums began when we understood what tuberculosis was. It's only when you can understand this past history that the changes really become so dramatic. In the earlier period, people were allowed to travel. They were allowed to mingle. They were very much a part of the community. Once it was understood that the disease was contagious, suddenly all that stopped, and it stopped very abruptly. And the sick were isolated. They were told to leave their homes, leave the communities. They became outcasts, and they were sent up to live. And the poor went to live in sanatoriums in the American situation, and the well-to-do lived in what I called the shadow of the sanatorium. And the whole relationship between physician and doctor changed, whereas in this earlier period, I'm describing a kind of negotiated relationship. But after 1882, all that changes. The physician gives the orders, and the patient is much more subservient to it. Another thing happens, which again has very little to do with medicine, which is that beginning in about 1870, the number of deaths from tuberculosis begin to decline, and they decline. The decline has nothing to do with therapy. We don't really know why the decline happened, but it increasingly became a disease of the poor and the immigrant. So put contagion next to poor and immigrant, put heightened medical authority next to people who aren't educated and who don't often have the skills to respond, and you can begin to understand the dimensions of the change.
You described some of the sanatoriums as being a cross between a prison and a hospital.
Yes, that was very distressing in that section of the book, particularly because we've all been raised with images of sanatoriums like the Magic Mountain. And we think of people kind of sitting there in a very bucolic setting, waiting, taking a cure, talking. It's a very intellectual, very refined environment. And the American sanatorium, and indeed most of the European ones as well, really weren't anything like that. They were set up for working class and for the very poor. And life in these places was often pretty grim. Many times people would be expected to work, but even if they weren't expected to work, there was a sense of having given up their autonomy, having given up their dignity for a promise of a cure. And it's really because of the way the disease was thought about and because they had a sense of themselves as being not treated well and not taken care of well. And in the narratives that people wrote about their experiences in the sanatorium, they have almost nothing good to say about the doctors and the nurses. All they can talk about were the rules they were forced to live by, was the fact that their lights had to be out at 9 o'clock, was the fact that they just had kind of no way of determining their daily life in any way. Everything was a rule. They were handed a book of rules, like one would expect in an incarcerative institution when they walked into the sanatorium and said, read all these rules and sign them. Sometimes they weren't even given a chance to sign them. And then from then on, 8 o'clock was this, 9 o'clock was this, 10 o'clock was this. One had to wait in bed for 6 weeks before one could get reading privileges or bathroom privileges. And they just felt incredibly confined.
I'd like to jump ahead to the present. and ask you if you think that there are things that you learned in your study of tuberculosis in the 18th and early 19th century that have some application to the AIDS epidemic today?
When I began this book, I really wasn't looking for anything that had to do with AIDS, but sometimes it was a little bit uncanny what one found. I think particularly in the earlier period when men were told to travel for health, they would often go, and since they were the ones I wrote about were New England men, they would take a boat from Boston or Portland or one of these places and go south. They would follow the shipping routes. And they often all wound up living on a few islands like Cuba or St. Croix or wherever the routes were going. And there they would form kind of surrogate communities where they would spend the winter months. And their diaries talk about how they would nurse each other, care for each other, pray with each other. And many of them, in a very disquieting, unsettled way, found themselves attending funeral after funeral and then having to write back home to the family about how their brother, son, or nephew had lived their final days. And that kind of was very much, to me, had a lot to do with the way we think about AIDS. And when I dealt with the women, the whole rallying around that the community did around the sick and dying, I thought that that had a lot to say to us as we're beginning to think about these epidemics today and how to help people who are going through this.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the return of tuberculosis. The numbers of people who have tuberculosis are rising, and there's more and more cases of tuberculosis that is resistant to antibiotics, and that's very frightening. So there's an issue now that public health departments face about whether to use coercive measures on people who aren't taking their medicine, and to either find a way to force them to take their medicine or to find a way to isolate them. What do you think are some of the biggest ethical questions we face now in treating tuberculosis?
I think that one of the points, and I think some of the public departments of public health are beginning to see this, is that one wants to try to make certain that one can do whatever one can without having to incarcerate people. Because once you get into the business of incarceration, you're always in that dilemma of, is this a hospital or a prison? How do we treat and detain? And I think this whole idea of directly observed therapy for people who won't take their medications when they should is a very important one, because it speaks to the fact that we understand the limits of what we can do with incarcerating people. But I don't mean in that way to sound that this disease is not contagious. It's very highly contagious, and people must really, for the safety of others and really for themselves too, be taking their medications. But what's very important, and I think the departments of health are starting to do this, is to find as many strategies as they can to encourage people to take their medications, make sure that they can get their medications easily. Nobody wants to stand in a hospital line for 4 hours twice a week or three times a week to get their to get their drugs. They're not going to do it. But if you can figure out ways to help them get drugs easier, if you can help those who aren't doing it, give them incentives to do it, that you might not have to set up these large incarcerative institutions with the problems that they have. And I think New York City has been very good about this. First, they had thought about the necessity for very large institutions, but now they've moved down to smaller institutions and to really only use them as a last resort.
Sheila Rothman is the author of Living in the Shadow of Death. This is Fresh Air.